It is well accepted that Jaws is an all-time great film, but its progeny don't rank nearly as high. Two True Freaks is proud to present Is It Jaws, where Paul Spitero and Sean Whalen are joined by an all-star list of guest hosts to review old and new films and place them on the Jaws scale, where they're ranked from Jaws to Jaws 4. Of course, for the purposes of the show, that scale does take some liberties with their actual ratings. Sure, movies that are given the ranking of Jaws are considered classic films with few flaws, if any. A ranking of Jaws 2 indicates that the film is very good and worthy of repeated viewings. A Jaws 3 ranking indicates the film was okay, but that's all. A Jaws 4 means it's ranked as a bad movie. Oh, and if you ever saw Back to the Future Part 2, you know that there's a Jaws 19. That ranking indicates that the movie is so incredibly bad that it's actually fun to watch as a result. So please join Paul and Sean as they ask the ever-important question, is it Jaws?
This is a national emergency.
Detonator charged.
We're in a race against the Nazis. And I know what it means. If the Nazis have a bomb.
Have a 12-month head start.
18.
How could you possibly know that?
We've got one hope.
All America's industrial might and scientific innovation connected here.
A secret laboratory. Keep everyone there until it's done.
Let's go recruit some scientists.
Build a town, build it fast. If we don't let scientists bring their families, we'll never get the best.
Why would we go to the middle of nowhere for who knows how long?
Why? Why? How about because this is the most important thing to ever happen in the history of the world?
You're the great improviser, but this... you can't do in your head.
Are we saying there's a chance that when we push that button, we destroy the world?
Chances are near zero.
Near zero.
What do you want from theory alone?
Zero would be nice.
This is a matter of life and death. But I can perform this miracle.
World War II would be over. Our boys would come home.
That's happening, isn't it?
The world will remember this day.
Our work here will ensure a peace mankind has never seen. Until somebody builds a bigger one.
You are the man who gave them the power to destroy themselves. And the world is not prepared.
Eight, 7, 6, 5, 4, 3.
Truman needs to know what's next.
2.
What's next?
1.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to Is It Jaws? I'm Paul Spitero, and as always, sitting metaphorically next to me is my good buddy, Mr. Sean Whalen.
It is a pleasure to be here, as always.
And it is a pleasure to have you. And Sean today brought one of his friends with him. So why don't we, that's Mr. Chris Kendall. Here, Chris, welcome aboard.
Thank you, gentlemen. Good morning.
Thanks for coming on. What's your... What's your background in, just in movies in general? I mean, you know, my background is I've taken a couple of classes, but realistically, I'm just a big movie fan. That's my only resume entry, really.
I would say the same thing. I'm just a huge, huge fan. When I was a lot younger, back in grade school, you could say I had aspirations of wanting to be maybe a filmmaker. A good friend of mine, a mutual friend of Sean's and mine, we went to grade school together, and in our middle school years, 7th and 8th grade, we used to make stop motion film using a Super 8 camera with like little clay figures, and then, you know, action figures lying around the house and stuff, and we would come up with like a little plot, and we would, you know, kind of go in the basement and spend the next 6 hours making a 3-minute movie.
Well, you know what? In 7th and 8th grade, that is state-of-the-art special effects.
Yes, yes. So it was a lot of fun. And then we, later on, we decided to give a shot at coming up with a small little plot story and then filming a live-action film down at one of the local beach clubs, because we're right here in Northeast Ohio, just outside Cleveland on the lakefront. And so back then you could say, you know, we had these fantasies and dreams of maybe one day being the next Steven Spielberg or George Lucas.
You know, when they first became available as far as, you know, video cameras to record, you know, your own home movies with, as opposed to Super 8 or whatever. Me and a good buddy of mine were, you know, high school / college age at that point. And we had aspirations. We made, you know, the biggest thing we made was a Saturday Night Live episode, because we were able to do one episode, you know, one skit at a time. And we still have it. And it's, you know, 40 something years old now. And it's, you know, it's by all, you know, objective standards, it's probably awful, but we still get a kick out of it and talk about it. And, you know, we both had dreams, and I went on to do nothing that has to do with film. And he's most recently directed, you know, the show Manifest, and he directed episodes of Dexter, and, you know, he's gone on to success. So
yeah,
it is cool, because I heard him in an interview where he credited me as his first filmmaking partner. So that's where my credibility begins and ends. Anyway, today we're here to review the movie Oppenheimer, which is the 2023 Best Picture. I'll start off by saying I did not see this in the movie theater, and that was probably a negative, because I think even though it's not a high action movie, I think it would benefit from a big screen presentation. You know, I did see it on, you know, a big screen home TV set, but that's not quite the same. And quite frankly, as I was saying before we started recording, it was a lot of information. There was a lot of information put forward in it. And I think I will eventually benefit from seeing it a second time. But at, you know, a 3 hour or so running time, I don't know that I'm going to watch it again really soon, but I do think when I watch it next, whenever that may be, I'm going to take in some more of the subtleties of the performances and of the, you know, the script and the direction and all of that. So I feel like I may have missed out on a little of that. I did find it pretty engrossing overall. A lot of people who I spoke to before I saw it, without giving me spoilers of the movies, and I guess since it's biographical, spoilers don't really matter that much. But anyway, the review I heard from most people was, yeah, it was very good, but I don't know if it was great. And that's, I guess, what we're going to discuss today. Because I don't think any of us are going to sit here and say this was a bad movie by any stretch of the imagination. But I think we're going to discuss, is it a great movie or is it a good movie? You know, I can't even compare it to the other movies that it was up against for Best Picture, because sadly, I haven't seen any of those yet. I probably will see at least, you know, most of them eventually. But you know, time is limited sometimes, and, you know, our movie choices, and, you know, I don't know. I do think it had the grand scale of a Best Picture type winner. But again, we'll talk about it as we go on. Why don't we go into our first experiences, or your first experiences, since I just gave mine. Sean, when did you see this on the big screen?
I did. Knowing that Nolan shoots his movies for IMAX, we are fortunate enough that a little bit of a drive from us at Crocker Park, they have a first-run IMAX theater. So I saw it there. It was a great experience to see it in IMAX. The only criticism I'll have is nothing to do with the film. It's IMAX theaters. The first three rows should not be there.
Absolutely.
Bad design choice. They should rip those seats out, throw them in the back. I don't care if I have to climb a ladder to get to the seats. It certainly would be much better than sitting in whiplash state for 3 hours, which was my only criticism with the experience was I loved seeing it in that grandeur. But when you're up in the third row, you're doing a lot of bobbing from your left to your right in order to really enjoy the film. I really am glad I saw it in that format the first time. This is a film, though, I think something you touched on earlier is really accurate with this film. This is a film, because of how much is in it, it really benefits from a second viewing. I think your first time through, you kind of do that, you know, initial watch that everybody does with a film, myself included. And the second time through, it's, you know, the basic story, you kind of know the pacing of the film and things like that. You can kind of touch in on the details. There's a lot going on in this film. And I say that in a positive way. There's depth to this film that's there. You're right on, I think seeing this on the big screen, anybody out there, if you've seen it only at home, it is, if it comes back around, which it's going to probably because of the nature of it, either to film festivals or, you know, we have something called the Cleveland Cinematheque here, where they'll bring back classic great movies from time to time. This is worth seeing in that experience, because there's something about the way this film was shot that there's certain films that you just need to kind of see that way. And this one certainly benefits from that. But the IMAX experience was certainly the ideal. If you're able to see it as somehow in IMAX, do that just because of the beauty of the piece. Chris, what about you? How did you first engage with
it? Well, I love Christopher Nolan, first off. And the buzz around this film, sad to say, I have not seen it on the big screen. As similarly like to Paul, and I regret that, and I'm hoping, fingers crossed, that we'll have that opportunity, because Nolan is such a master of, you know, his craft, and he likes to take every opportunity to use, you know, some of the latest stuff in film. He's huge with the IMAX, like Sean mentioned. So I saw it, you know, in 4K on our living room, high depth television. But I do think that this, because of who the director is, and it really would benefit to see it on the big screen. So, and I've only seen it the one time, and I was very tempted to watch it a second time in anticipation of speaking with you, gentlemen, but I thought, you know what, this might benefit more to just get my initial thoughts on the film were, and so that's what I wanted to kind of bring here to the table, so to speak.
Now, I have a pet peeve, so to speak, and I cannot address it for this film, but Sean and I have talked in the past. I think we talked about it when we reviewed Elvis. My pet peeve is when you present a movie that is biographical or factual, or at least presented as factual. I don't like when they play fast and loose with the facts of, you know, what really happened, or when they take leaps of faith as to what happened when they don't really know. And I think sometimes you have to, by the very nature of what you're doing. You're not involved in the intimate conversations that these people have. They weren't recorded. So you have to deal with, you know, kind of speculating as to what went on. I don't have a problem with the fact that it's done, But I do have a problem when factual things are presented and everybody just says, well, that's what happened. You know, they treat it as a textbook, you know, a history textbook, as opposed to a dramatization. I'm not sure how much of this varied off of real life, quite frankly. I mean, I am somewhat familiar with, you know, the historical nature of Los Alamos and the Manhattan Project and all of that. But I don't really know about the inner workings of it. I don't know if everything in this movie happened the way they show it, or if there's some liberties that they took. And I don't know if either of you, I'm throwing this at you blindly, I don't know if either of you have any greater knowledge going into this. If not, I say we just take this as a dramatization and we don't worry about its factual nature. But if either of you has any knowledge, then sure, I would like to hear about it right now.
If I could jump in, it's interesting you bring that up, Paul, because one of the things as I was watching it the first time was, you know, how Nolan uses the color sequences, and then when he focuses on the Strauss character played by Robert Downey Jr., those are all in black and white. And I was trying to figure out for myself. So then I've subsequently, you know, did a couple of Google searches, like, why did Nolan film in black and white? And to your point about dramatization versus, you know, facts, I heard the scenes with Strauss, that is done in black and white to represent the object truth, the objective truth, if you will. So that part of the film is pretty close to like the historical aspect of the film. Whereas the film sequences in color that focus more on Oppenheimer, the color representing the Oppenheimer story is more subjective. And that's where I think the filmmakers, to your point about, you know, Nolan wasn't there when Oppenheimer had these intimate conversations with his colleagues and things as they were working on the thing. So that's where Nolan probably, and, you know, they kind of sometimes have to use that artistic license, if you will. But okay, I think overall, I think he gets the big picture is pretty historically accurate.
Yeah, I don't really have a problem with some artistic license, because I think sometimes you have to do that just to make a cohesive film with a narrative that flows. I have more of an issue when they actually just change facts. You know, that's when things bother me a little bit. You know, as an example, I'll give you in the movie Bohemian Rhapsody, they changed the sequence of Freddie Mercury finding out that he had AIDS and when it happened, and when it happened in relation to the big concert that's at the end. And that's playing a little fast and loose with the facts, as opposed to just changing them, you know, to streamline a story or something along those lines. You know, there's a distinct difference there. And again, I'm not really able to comment on the factual nature. There's nothing in here that I'm going to say, oh, I know this didn't happen, or, you know, anything like that. But it is, you know, it is interesting. And certainly I have a great deal of respect for filmmakers who do their best to get it as factually correct as possible. And I have every reason to think that Nolan did that here. But again, I don't really have a lot of basis for that, other than that I just have some faith.
Right.
I didn't know that. I find it intriguing that he shot it with base being able to say, these are the things I can verify are factual. You know, these are the sequences that like we know are a known thing. But to Chris's point, intimate conversations with his wife, intimate conversations with the girl he was seeing, things like that that were going on in the film, he wouldn't have been a fly on the wall for those things. And a lot of that's not going to be accurately documented. So I like that he made a real attempt in the film to use kind of visual styling to kind of tell you we're framing the film up in these historical facts, and I'm trying to kind of get you into the head of somebody in a way that I think they were probably thinking during all of this, versus, to your point, Paul, presenting everything is 100% factual when you can't possibly know that.
And you know, if you know the nature of Oppenheimer's relationship with his wife, you know, you don't know the details, but you know the general nature of it. And if you know the general nature of his relationship with his side lover, and you know their politics, and you know how they kind of met and things like that, you can present a fictional relationship between them that still kind of skirts the truth enough that you feel comfortable watching it, that this is probably along the lines of what they had in their relationship. And I'm okay with that, because obviously, you know, there isn't anybody who's transcribing those private conversations. So, you know, I'm good with that. It, like I said, it's just when they take big, you know, just big things in reality and just say, well, you know, I'm going to change it because it presents it as a more dramatic thing, or I'm going to change it because the timing of it works better. You know, that bothers me. If you're going to do that, then don't do a biopic, as far as I'm concerned. You know, I'm just going to point to Bohemian Rhapsody and say they could have presented it the way it really happened, and it could have been just as well done. You know, you have to be a little creative with how you put it together, but that's not a problem. You know, to change it from the real facts bothers me. Anyway, let's talk a little Christopher Nolan here. We'll do him a little bit before we do the casting. I like Christopher Nolan. I think he's an excellent filmmaker. But I'm going to throw the butt on it. I think a few of his movies become a little self-indulgent. I think there is that risk. And some of them are movies that people really, really liked that I wasn't so crazy about. I didn't really like Interstellar that much. I didn't like Inception all that much. I really disliked Insomnia. I thought Insomnia was what I said when I saw Insomnia when it first came out was Insomnia is a cure for insomnia. So, you know, I do think he can be a little self-indulgent. I haven't seen Tenet, but I heard that is self-indulgent. Although, you know, then to talk the other side of the coin, you know, I think Memento is an excellent movie. I think the Batman movies, I know The Dark Knight Rises got some criticism, but I think all three of them just present really, really well. I really, really liked The Prestige. So, you know, we have the two sides of the spectrum with him. And despite my thoughts that sometimes he's a little self-indulgent with some of the movies, I cannot question the man's talent for a second. Even the movies that I'm not crazy about are extremely well put together. So I think that's the case here. I didn't find it to be particularly self-indulgent. I thought it was much more along the lines of I'm looking to create an epic scale to something that is historically epic, but doesn't necessarily have all that many epic moments for me to present. And I'm going to have to try and build them up and all of that. Because with the exception of when they test the bomb, there isn't really that dramatic, oh my God, you know, this is the scene that we've been waiting for type thing in here. But I do think he presents it. He builds up the tension with what's going on. I think he did a really good job, which is one of his things where, you know, you're going back and forth in time. I do think he did a good job with that to kind of keep that tension rising as the movie went on. I think he gave people, and we're going to talk about this a little bit when we get to Robert Downey Jr., but I think he gave people ample screen time to kind of project their characters where needed. And other characters were a little bit minor, and you know, you didn't see quite as much of them, but you did have revisits to people, and you'd say, oh yeah, that was the guy from earlier. I think he did a good job of taking a very, very complex story and presenting it in a narrative flow that worked for me. That as it went on, I kept feeling that light bulb above my head go on, where I would say, oh, that's where that was leading to, and that's what that was going to. And I think that was a real strength of this movie, that he did that. And it was a movie that
called for you not to multitask because you did need to pay attention, or you were going to miss out on what that person's role was in his life, or why it was important to know what that person did. But as it went on, I do think you kind of, like I said, you kind of felt, okay, now I'm getting it. And I think that's where it's going to benefit from the second viewing, because now I'm going to see, okay, I know what this character does later, and now I'm going to see how he builds up earlier, and I'm going to be able to see a little bit more with the acting performance, or with the direction, or with the storytelling, where I'm going to see, oh, you know, this is where we're getting some foreshadowing that I didn't realize, and things like that. So, again, I think this movie will benefit from a second viewing very much.
One of the things that I like about doing director studies, and we've been doing them, Hitchcock one in particular is one that we're kind of tackling on a heavy end. We've been talking about doing along the way. One of the things about that journey that's neat is everyone has a different experience with how they interact with the director. But I think it's also getting to know who the director is, what they're trying to accomplish as a filmmaker. One of the things I really like about Nolan, and this is, goes with all of my favorite directors, it's not about whether or not you love every one of their movies. Somebody could be, you know, out of the three of us right now, we might have very different experiences as far as how we feel about each of Nolan's films. I like that he is playing with the medium. I like that he is a distinctive director. You know, when you go to see a Nolan film, you know you've seen a Nolan movie. There's certain things he's trying to do with the screen. There's certain things he's trying to do. He crafts movies specifically for the big screen experience, which I always appreciate as a film goer, just in the sense that we're in this time where I think as film goers, what is film going to be in the next decade? You know, and are there going to be authentic experiences that make it worth going to the theater? I really appreciate it. This is a film, and I encourage both of you to do it. If this comes back around and there's an opportunity to see it on the big screen, see this on the big screen. It really is a film that kind of benefits from that spectacle. And there's not a lot of TV at home. I like seeing films at home. I'm in the comfort of my home with my snacks and my, you know, drinks, and, you know, being able to enjoy the comfort of my couch. It's definitely an experience. This is one where I honestly say sitting in whiplash mode for 3 hours was worth it. and that's, you know, I wasn't in the most comfortable of areas to see the film because of it, but I got to see this on the big screen. He shoots it that way. There are sequences that I really, really enjoyed from this, where especially kind of seeing the younger Oppenheimer, because I think you needed that in this film, because this is Nolan's vision of who he sees Oppenheimer as based on the story. And in those younger idealistic years, you see a man who's not perfect. And I really, it's one of the things that I really liked about the vision here. This was a journey. And I love films that are journeys. And getting to see this man when he was enthusiastic, energetic, idealist about being a physicist. His goals were to be able to do something big, to be able to discover some big things, and get that validation of that, to the point where there's stuff we're going to talk about as we go forward with this, where you have that piece and sometimes you're not thinking about every aspect of what that discovery is going to mean. And I liked that this was not a perfect journey. It was a very humane journey. And that was something that part of the spectacle of this. Nolan takes you on a journey. And it's to your point, Paul, I don't know that it's about loving every film of Nolan's. It's about understanding him as a filmmaker. And this is a fun one to talk about, I think, because this is a film, right? And wherever we all fall on this film, you know, if we're all in the same spot or we're in three different places, these are kind of the fun journeys to talk about as a film goer, as far as what was your authentic experience like with this? And I can tell even just kind of from our initial conversations, the three of us might be in three different places, and that's kind of fun.
Mm-hmm. We're going to see what places we're in. What do you think, Chris?
Like Sean, the thing that attracts me to Nolan, and I think that I'll preface it by saying I think he is probably our most dynamic and I think talented filmmaker right now. And I'll go so far to say he's the closest thing, in my view, to what Stanley Kubrick was. A master of the craft of filmmaking. And again, I'm sure that, you know, we know Kubrick didn't make many films. But when a Kubrick film came out, you were excited to see what Stanley Kubrick put on film. And I feel that way about Christopher Nolan too, that his mastery of the craft of filmmaking. And like Sean had said, that's why I'm disappointed that I didn't like kick myself and get out to the west side of here, get the Crocker Park to, because they have one of their theaters is, you know, IMAX specifically, and that's Nolan's, you know, that's his calling card. Yeah, he's the closest thing, I think, to Stanley Kubrick. And I think Nolan, I think one of his biggest influences might have been Stanley. So
I think that's a real interesting comparison. I'm sorry to interrupt you.
Yeah, no worries. But it is just exciting to see what Nolan's going to come up with next, or what approach he's going to take to telling the story he's going to tell you.
I think it's a real interesting comparison, because I think there is some definite similarity. You know, it's except for some older filmmakers, you know, the Martin Scorsese's of the world. I don't think there's any right now directors out there that have that rock star director feeling that Christopher Nolan has, you know, in his age group. I think Christopher Nolan's, you know, in his 50s at this point.
Right.
You know, and you have, you know, like I said, you have, you know, Martin Scorsese, Francis Ford Coppola, those guys who are still around. But I don't think there's as many people like that as there once were, who were, you know, big name directors. There's certainly very talented and good directors out there, but there aren't too many people right now who come out and you say, oh, this is a film by this guy. Christopher Nolan might be the one right now as far as the young guys. You know, he's not, again, you know, Martin Scorsese, Steven Spielberg, you know, they're all older now. I'm not saying that they can't do great work yet to come, but, you know, it's a little different. But, you know, I talked about earlier, you know, I mentioned that some of Nolan's work feels a little self-indulgent, but you never question his ability as a filmmaker to put it together and create a, you know, a film as opposed to a movie, if that distinction means anything to you. And Kubrick's the same way. And we've talked about doing a kind of a retrospective on Kubrick and going through all his movies and seeing it. I think I'm going to have a similar take on what I just said. There's going to be some movies where I'm going to say, wow, this one is great. And then there's other ones where I'm going to say, yeah, this one was a little self-indulgent, or this one was, you know, was not really a subject that should have been attacked, or whatever the case may be. But I don't think I'm ever going to question his ability to put together a good film, of, you know, or to put a film together well. I may not always think they're a good film. But, you know, again, it's not going to ever be a question, I don't think, of questioning the man's talent. And I think that's what we're looking at here with Nolan, right, a little bit. I would never question the talent. It's sometimes the topics or the way he chooses to attack it that I might feel a little differently about. In this particular instance, I thought he attacked it really, really well. I thought he created a flow to it, despite the fact that you had flashback scenes in there. And sometimes that's a dangerous thing when you put those flashback scenes in there, because you could be taking the viewer out of the moment. But I think when you use them carefully and you put them in the right spots, they can be very, very effective. And I thought he did that in this movie.
I would agree.
So now, you know, we talk about the rock star, or I mentioned the rock star film directors, and, you know, over the years, what I've always found fascinating is when you get those guys and they have their certain actors that they go back to all the time. And it's interesting to see Cillian Murphy as one of those guys. I didn't realize quite how many of Nolan's movies he was in. I remembered him, you know, playing the Scarecrow and having that little part, but I didn't realize that, you know, he's got a lot more connection to Nolan than I thought. He's clearly one of Nolan's guys. He's I mentioned Scorsese, you know, he's just what like Robert De Niro or Leonardo DiCaprio is to Scorsese, that, you know, he keeps going back to him. And I find that that's interesting, because sometimes you feel like you're putting a square peg in a round hole by casting a guy that, well, this is a guy I like to work with, even though he doesn't necessarily fit the part. But I think if you did a casting call of Hollywood, I'm not sure you'd find anybody much better for the role of Oppenheimer than Cillian Murphy. So I just found it fascinating the way the two just kind of come together, because he really seemed to fit this role so well and seemed different than anything I ever saw him in before. I don't question the fact that he got Best Actor for this movie. I thought he was outstanding. And I thought a lot of it was something that I respect, which is kind of underplaying the role a little bit at points, where you have to kind of watch his eyes and his facial expressions and how his body movements are to kind of understand what the character is thinking, as opposed to him just coming out and saying, well, I feel this way. You know, it isn't all laid out on the screen for you, or it is all laid out, but it's only laid out if you're really paying attention to what he's doing. And I feel like that's where acting really stands out in my mind, when you get people who do that. What did you guys think of him in this movie?
I thought that the casting of Cillian Murphy was almost spot on. It's interesting. There's the book about Oppenheimer, the biography. It's called American Prometheus. And on the cover, there's a shot. I think it has Oppenheimer wearing his famous that hat,
fedora.
That style of fedora that he wore. And then there was a publicity shot of Murphy kind of, you know, decked out in the same thing and the cigarette dangling from the mouth. And I'm like, wow, this is almost like spot on casting. And like you said, you go through a director's filmography, and sometimes you'll see that certain directors have like their go-to actor, and to your point about, you know, Martin Scorsese and De Niro, I think they've teamed up now 10 times, with the most recent film that Scorsese did this year. Killing of the Flower Moon or whatnot. And Leonardo happens to be in that one as well. Like you said, sometimes those pairings or those collaborations, if you will, in the case of De Niro with Scorsese, every character is different. And sometimes you can, you know, sometimes get typecast as, you know, just, well, you're my buddy, I'm going to put you in my films. But I think the use of Cillian in the different roles that he's played for Nolan, and obviously the Batman trilogy as Scarecrow character, but I think he was also in Dunkirk. He was in Inception. I'm not sure if there's any other in the Nolan canon that he was in, but I thought his casting was perfect.
Am I accurate on this? I thought that this was one of those films where a number of the cast members who were actually trying out for certain roles and actually got moved to different roles. Am I right about that?
I'm not sure. I couldn't tell you that. I don't know.
I'm not sure either, honestly.
As far as the casting of him, when you're doing a 3-hour movie, it's a long movie. You mentioned before, Paul, about how much there is to this film. There's a lot going on. And I think if you're going to spend 3 hours with a character, there comes a point in time where you've got to stop seeing the actor and you've got to start feeling they're that person. And I felt like this film did that. I felt he was Oppenheimer. I was interested in seeing his journey. I was ready to scold him for his flaws. that's part of the piece over there where you start believing this is somebody you're actually in real time interacting with. And that's the kind of the emotional journey, I think, of a good film. is when you're starting to get invested in the character, their choices, their decisions, the actions that take place, not just the big event, because this is a film where you could focus very heavily on the big event, right? We know what this is building to, that there's a historical moment that this film is surrounding, but this was much more about this character's journey to that. A lot more than the actual event itself. And if you're not invested in him, the film loses itself. And I felt like that was a victory. You're right. He deserved the award for this. And I really enjoyed going on the journey. I enjoyed hanging with Oppenheimer, which is a weird thing to say. But I did.
Yeah, no, I agree. So then the next guy I wanted to bring up, I normally would bring up Robert Downey Jr. here since he won Best Supporting Actor. But I think first I want to mention Matt Damon, because quite honestly, about two-thirds of the way through the movie, I was actually thinking, because the Academy Awards had already happened, the awards were already given, and I was thinking to myself, if I was going to give a Best Supporting Actor Oscar in this movie, it would be to Damon, not Robert Downey. Because at that point, Robert Downey's part had seemed almost like a cameo in the movie, and Matt Damon had some, you know, significant movement, even though he was not the lead actor. And I thought he did very, very well bringing it along. And I was appreciating his acting while I was taking note of the fact that he had a much more significant role at least two-thirds of the way through the movie. And I'm curious if you guys had any kind of realization of that or thoughts about that.
He had a difficult part to play. Because what ends up happening is there's a certain point in time in the film where he has to, like, he was in this lead position with Oppenheimer. And they had a very interesting relationship, you know, where it's not there's times where they're kind of buddy-buddy. And there's other times where, you know, he's got to basically deal with the fact that he's almost Oppenheimer's handler. But
it's exactly right. That's a good call.
But later on in the film, there's this moment where, you know, they're trying to clearly discredit Oppenheimer and you know, push him to the background and brand him as a traitor and all those pieces. And he's faced with, this is what our rules are now for interacting with people who could potentially be politically charged in a way that shouldn't be granted access. They shouldn't be granted privileges, things like that. He's faced with looking at those and has to present himself and say, okay, I wouldn't approve him now. I wouldn't approve him now. But you could feel on him the fact that he's trying to be professional. He's trying to be ethical in what he's saying. And they have that great moment where they flash back to him afterwards. He says, but I'm not trying to disparage the man. I'm poorly paraphrasing it. But, you know, you clearly see that he's recognizing what I have just said is damning, but I'm not trying to be. And I loved the humanity of that. Like, it felt authentic. It felt real. An example of a character, you're right, I don't hear about him talked about as much as I hear about Robert Downey, and I really liked Robert Downey in this, but Damon played a very key role there, because if you're going to feel something truly is a smear campaign, and you feel like that they're really out to get somebody, you need those characters that make you feel that, and he did in that moment, where he's trying to, you're putting this in front of me, you're asking me to answer honestly, ethically, I have to answer you honestly, and I am. But I'm not trying to hurt this man behind me. I'm not trying to discredit this man. I'm trying to answer the question you posed before me that is putting a fence around me. And that sequence, there's so much that's done in that sequence that I thought was brilliant, in the fact that he didn't say all those things that I'm saying right now. He portrayed all of those things. And that's where I think he was a victory in this. And sometimes it is your smaller, it's weird to say smaller characters because he was in the whole film, but he is. He's not, you know, Oppenheimer's role is a much larger role in this. he had key moments in this that I think if you don't go on the whole journey with Matt Damon, that moment doesn't mean as much. That was another character that I thought, wow, that sequence was so much better because of the way he portrayed it. And what he didn't say was just as important as what he did, because he was able to portray it in a way where you did not need them to spell it out. You lived it with them. And that's where I think you're right to note him, because I thought he did just a terrific job.
Yeah, I'm going to second everything that Sean said too. I think acting performance, I think this might rank as Damon's best, and what he brought to the film. And because initially, you know, the character he's playing, you're thinking, okay, you know, this big time general who's overseeing the Manhattan Project. And the way Damon portrayed that character did bring a certain amount of, you know, humanity to his role and that conflict that he had between his respect for the man who helped end World War II, and then also, you know, the government's effort to, you know, revoke his clearance and basically smear him as in the times of, you know, the McCarthy era, if you will, and that dilemma. And to see, you know, Matt Damon, you know, pull it off without being too grandiose or whatnot was good. And I don't even think he was even considered, was he, in that category? Because he very well easily could have been right alongside, you know, Robert Downey Jr.
Reed, I agree with everything you're both saying about him. I thought that the performance, again, it added some of that subtlety, kind of what Sean described about, you know, how he was torn. He's trying to do right by the government and do his job the right way, but he's also trying to do right by this man who he has grudgingly developed respect for as they've proceeded in this project. And you know, he was torn, clearly, and was trying to do the right thing as opposed to just picking a side. So I thought that was excellently done. And again, a lot of that was done in the last third of the movie, but 2/3 of the way through the movie, I saw Robert Downey at that point as a glorified cameo. And then in the last third, all of a sudden he comes to the forefront as the guy who's very career minded. And in order to move his career forward, decides he needs to throw Oppenheimer under the bus. And, you know, presents himself as a villain all of a sudden in the movie, which I just think is phenomenal, the way it turned and felt realistic. He was not quite as subtle in his performance because he needed to spell out what he was doing, but I thought it was very, very believable in how he presented it. And you know, by the end of the movie, if this was the old times, you know, you would have been hissing and wanting to throw Rotten Tomatoes at him, which was great. He, like I said, he turned on a dime and became the villain of the piece. And you saw the way he was manipulating the process that was going to go on. And that felt very, very realistic. And it probably was very realistic. But, you know, that's kind of, you know, how people take red tape in government and do things. And I thought he just really stood out from that moment on to the point where it was almost like, you know, for a third of the movie, he was as much of a lead as Cillian Murphy. And I thought that was just really kind of, again, I give credit to Nolan for the way he put it together. And I give credit to Downey for being able to just kind of take over at that point and just run with the role. So I thought it was a deserved Best Supporting Actor Oscar that he took. But again, 2/3 of the movie, way through the movie, I was thinking, is this kind of one of these Lifetime Achievement Awards where they feel like he's a really good actor and they want to give it to him for something, so they had an opportunity? Right. And then as it went on, then all of a sudden it just kind of came out and it showed me what he really did. And I thought he was great.
Oh, no question. No question. And I like you just hit one of my biggest pet peeves with the Academy about how you look at an actor's body of work and then they give them like an Oscar as a for lack of a better term, outside a Lifetime Achievement Award. They give him a Best Actor or Best Supporting Actor statuette, and you're like, this is what he got it for? Or she got it for? And, Paul Newman is the perfect
yeah, absolutely, example. I was just going to say that.
You know, he gets it for The Color of Money, and Newman's body of work, not to say that Color of Money and his performance wasn't good, but he's reprising his classic role of Fast Eddie Felsen from The Hustler. He should have won for that one. Or I think his magnum opus was The Verdict. He should have won Best Actor, but I think that was also the year that Kingsley was up for Gandhi. So, you know, but Downey's was well deserved. It was such a great performance, and really shows his scope as an actor. You know, aside from the perfect casting of him as Tony Stark / Iron Man, which he relished and plays to great effect, but in this drama, he was great. And I think this was the first movie since maybe Dallas Buyers Club where you had the two best act statuettes for acting, supporting and lead, went to the same film.
One of the things that I thought this film portrayed well that was really important was the relationship with his wife. It's complicated.
Right.
There's no other way to say it. The thing that was interesting is there is a subtext of she has her own issues that are going on. She has her own humanity. Even when they have a child, you know, you start to see those pieces where she's not... She's got some flaws in parenting and as far as, you know, needs to get away from it almost, you know, where they're going through that as a couple. In the meantime, we all know as viewers, she's living with a man who's having multiple affairs, you know, or has, you know, at that point in time. Oppenheimer's own morality is something that is kind of questionable at times. Yet I always believed throughout the entire film, and this is where it's critical, the two of them love each other. They're complicated individuals. They're quirky individuals. And even saying quirky is not really broadcasting enough what I would want to say about them. But I felt like the romantic relationship in this film was, I thought, an interesting journey in and of itself. To your point about a lot going on, I think that's in itself like a sub-movie that you're watching throughout this process of, and that's where casting, I think, was key. There was certain pieces where they were hinted at. There was a certain affair that was right in our face. And I think the casting of the players in those particular, the female casting in this was really, really strong, I thought.
I agree, but I do think the female characters were more for backstory than the actual story, so they didn't stand out to me as much, even though I thought they did a really good job, and I don't mean to minimize their roles in the movie, but I do think they were well cast and they were well played. You know, we're talking about Emily Blunt and Florence Pugh, basically, and I thought they both did a very good job with it, so I don't want to minimize them, but they were not the key parts in this. They were more like to give us a background feel for the character of Robert Oppenheimer and what his life was like. So, you know, that I'm probably saying it very badly. But yeah, I thought they were important and they played their parts well, but they were smaller parts.
Emily, I agree with everything you're saying. Emily Blunt had some key sequences, though, that I think are critical to the film. Lines that she had where it kind of, she's almost smacking him in the face, but also making a statement. Like she said things, you don't get to commit sin and then ask all of us to feel sorry for you when there are consequences. And, you know, I mean, things like that where she's in her. And I mean, the way that she said it was just, I mean, there was a whole piece there where you see her kind of her strength. You think because you let them tar and feather that the world will forgive you? They won't. Because she was critical throughout the entire process where he is being attacked. Like, why won't you fight? Like, you're letting them do this. Why won't you fight? There comes a point in time where the fight does get involved in this whole thing, and it was great to see when it did. But I like that she was kind of the rock. And I agree with you. Everything you're saying as far as her being a smaller role, she was supposed to be. And I think the female leads in this one, the female characters in this one, were meant to be those pieces that did kind of flesh those things out because they were smaller roles. But I thought she had some key sequences in this that I thought were just whoa moments. And I really appreciated her portrayal of this character because some of those smacks came in at a time where, again, when you're watching a 3-hour movie, you need those moments that make you go, oh, wait, there's something going on here. Now let me buckle up. And she really served that purpose, even from a cinematic standpoint, as far as sometimes those lines came in at the right time that made me go, whoa, she's right. I need to watch what this guy's doing right now because he's making some choices.
Good, very good points.
Yeah, I think her character was key. In a lot of ways, she was the stronger of the two characters in terms of, you know, her moral fiber as a person. And, you know, in real life, the character she's portraying, I think, is a Kitty Oppenheimer. Mm-hmm. That's her name. She was a scientist in her own right. And she put her aspirations as a scientist on the back burner for her husband, and of course, you know, probably during that time period, that was almost like what was expected of your spouse, your the female, the wife, if you will. But she was, you know, like Sean had mentioned, she was kind of like the rock that kind of kept him somewhat grounded, you know, especially during those key points where, you know, he's still maintaining that affair with that communist.
Looking at the cast list, I would put Emily Blunt and Florence Pugh in this category as well, but I think we've already discussed them. There are certain actors who stood out to me either just because of the way they presented, and I thought they, again, stood out, for lack of a better term, or I thought they played a critical role in the moving forward of things that again, stood out to me. So I just wanted to mention a couple of them. The first one that came to mind for me was Jason Clarke in the role of Roger Robb. My knowledge of Jason Clarke really comes from Dawn of the Planet of the Apes and Terminator Genesis. Those are the two movies that I really know him in, and I actually did not really care for him in Terminator Genesis. I didn't know, or I didn't think, that he would be able to pull off a part with great gravitas. And I think as the guy who was basically the bullet in the gun of Robert Downey Jr.'s character that he shot at Oppenheimer, I thought he did a really good job of the way he controlled that hearing, the way it just seemed very, very realistic to me. Any thoughts on him?
I think you're right as far as the realistic piece. I think one of the things that I think this film did well, it was funny when you talk about films like this sometimes having those dramatizations that are in there, right? You know, as far as what is really historical and what's a dramatic moment for the film. I think you need those people that are able to do the portrayal that keep you feeling this is real, this is thriving, this is happening. Anytime you're touching on something where there's historical events and you want to feel like there's an accuracy to what you're doing, and that's a danger of film, right? It's sometimes believing that a dramatization is 100% factual as you're going through. I do on that journey, though, want to feel like I'm being transported to a time. I'm being transported to real events. And I agree. I think the realism that was brought with that acting was pretty critical at some key times. It's I needed to feel this was real. That's an example of a portrayal that I think just added to some things aren't set. The actors can create a set of sorts, kind of feeling. And I felt like that was something that was happening there.
Yeah, those behind the scenes political dealings and the intrigue was you know, excellent, the way they portrayed that as well. You know, you kind of felt like you were in the middle of those hearings on Capitol Hill.
You're also people that in real time are finding out things about each other and having to react to them. Because some sequences had some very harsh realities where it's like, wait a minute, you did this and kept it from me? And I mean, there were so many of those sequences in there where loyalties and allegiances were called into question. And we got to see those reactions from a very humane standpoint. You know, like, I was a believer in you, I was supporting you, and you did this to me. That kind of reality being brought to those political dealings behind the scenes, I think were great, because you had the big hearings, but then you had the private conversations that were going on in the background, and you got to see some real-time reactions that a lot of that stuff, while I know those were black and white and more of the historical sequences that are there, there wouldn't have been transcripts of some of those conversations, but you had to know, like, probably from accounts, you know, firsthand accounts of what were happening there, what happened in the sequences. Wow, those were powerful moments. Because it actually laid the stage for Robert Downey Jr.'s character and what you wanted to see happen to him.
Right.
That's part of the rally cry of this, right? You're watching this movie, and you're invested in his fate. The film's called Oppenheimer. Yes, because he's doing things to Oppenheimer, you're invested. But you're also invested in him as a three-dimensional character. But that's not just Robert Downey Jr. I'm not diminishing him. If you've only got these key players that are delivering home runs, you run into a problem. Because it's always going to be, you remember those sequences, and the whole world doesn't feel fleshed out. Boy, those behind-the-scenes dealings, there were actors in there who were bringing that to life because of the way that they were reacting. Sometimes single lines, you know, somebody may have only had like a couple of key lines, but those key lines were almost the, you know, their reaction to their own personal slaps to the face, and how they were almost rooting for his downfall because of what happened, I thought was an interesting part of the journey as well, and added something to this.
Now, a really very small part, but one that I thought was really important, kind of had a little bit of a turn of the film, and I just loved the portrayal, was Tom Conti as Einstein. I just really felt like he was Einstein, and Tom Conti, I've seen over the years, a lot of times he's one of those this guy actors who's been in so many things that you say, oh, I know this guy. Well, you know, what else was he in? But I mainly know him like playing almost comedic roles. I just, like I said, he just stood out to me, even though it was such a small part. I mean, he's probably on screen for maybe 5 minutes of the movie. But again, really stood out. And then they did make him kind of a pivotal. They didn't make him, I guess history made him. But he was a pivotal part of just, you know, the way everybody was kind of viewing what went on. So you kept having the flashback to that one scene. And I just, like I said, he just stood out to me.
What was great about that sequence is it's the bookends, right? And there's a lot of what was actually said. And right. I love that different characters had different ideas on what was actually said. The power was when we finally learn what that conversation looked like, and it was nothing like what certain characters were assuming. It shows how paranoia will overtake you. I thought he did a great job. And because that's an interesting part to try to play, right, Einstein? I mean, yeah. He's his own sort of unique personality. And I just thought their interactions, because of who Oppenheimer was and what he brought to the table, I think it's easy sometimes when you get to people that are at that level of intellect to have trouble portraying them in a way where relatable and human. And I thought both Einstein and Oppenheimer, which are characters that you can play so wooden and so above you that they're unlikable, unrelatable. The film did a very good job of still making them feel like they were up there, you know, with all of the intellect they got with, like, Einstein. Again, he wasn't throughout the film, like, constant. He was a smaller role, but you still felt like he was up there. He's a different level of person. You respect the intellect and what he brings to the table, but yet I liked him. And I think that's an interesting, tricky balance to find. And I think this film did a very good job of that, too. Because if you can't feel like you at least on some level are able to relate to these characters, that'll turn you off to a film pretty darn fast. And that was something that was, a victory in the portrayals of these characters as well.
Yeah, and I think that even though it was, as far as screen time, very minor, the subtlety of which the Einstein character was played, because I think there's always this temptation to, you know, we think of brilliant scientists and everything, you know, the first thing comes to mind is Einstein, and then that turns into caricature more than character, you know, because I think you get the idea of like a, you know, like in Back to the Future, Christopher Lloyd's portrayal of Doc Brown with the crazy hair and everything, you know, like I always think that, and I don't know this for sure, but I always think that this is where we get the idea of the mad scientist, because Einstein had that coif of crazy, you know, gray white hair, you know. So every portrayal of a mad scientist, it seems to me like in films, is kind of a caricature of Einstein. But in this, you know, film, you know, Einstein is a pivotal character, not just to the film, but, you know, historically as well. And in the lead up to getting the green light to do the Manhattan Project, because of our fear that the Nazis would beat us to control the atom.
Another part that was very small, but felt significant to me, was Gary Oldman as Harry Truman. And I want to preface this by saying I don't trust any politicians to show us publicly what they really are. And that doesn't matter whether it's a Democrat or Republican. It doesn't matter which side of the fence you're on. I feel like they all present to you what they think is going to benefit them. And I think they all want to some extent, you know, some of them are genuine that they want to help the world. But I think, you know, in order to play the game, they have to do certain things. Now, I really liked the way it was developed, how when Oppenheimer went to see Truman after the bomb was dropped, and initially Truman thought, okay, I got to deal with this scientist geek here, but he's helpful to me, so I'm going to act as if I'm really in his corner. Until Oppenheimer showed him that he isn't in his corner, and then the way Truman was so dismissive of him immediately at that point, I have to say I don't know that I've ever seen Gary Oldman in a part where I didn't think he was great, and even as small as this part was, it stood out to me because of just the way he turned on a dime, to, you know, from the phony welcoming him in to the get him out of here kind of attitude. It stood out to me again.
That fleshes out too who Oppenheimer is, right? And how when you're dealing with somebody like him, who Oppenheimer was. If there's one thing that happens in this film, Oppenheimer's Oppenheimer all the time. Like, he doesn't have a political side. And you're talking, you know, you were mentioning politicians before. I think that was something, his interactions and dealings with politicians and with people in authority, he doesn't have a politically correct side. He's himself all the way through the film. And I think that when you're portraying somebody like him, who's a scientist, who has the scientific enthusiasm, he's, you know, there are many times during the film, he's like sitting here trying to encourage the idea of partnerships with the Russians, partnerships with anybody who can enhance his own scientific learning to move forward the scientific process. So you see him as a scientist doing that, even though we know from his interactions and dealings too, he's an intelligent man that realizes why that's not happening. He still tries to sneak that stuff in because it's the scientific enthusiasm of, we can speed up the discovery. We can take it to the next level. We can learn something more. And whenever they did have dealings with what was going on in other countries, and they got to grab some nugget from it, you felt that enthusiasm in the room. When it comes to his interactions with the president, it was so great because it's a small moment, you know, realistically in the runtime of the film, but incredibly powerful because the president felt authentic. He's like, get this guy out. It's like, look, I need somebody else that's like going to now pull the rug out from underneath me, or, you know, it's I'm making the big decisions here. What's he doing? Because Truman, I mean, and it's come up more than once in the film that at least to a certain point in the film, Oppenheimer was protected to a certain extent from the decisions that were going to be made. Even when they take the bomb at a certain point in time, they bring up the point of saying, you know, you're done now. This is our thing now. We're going to take off that piece, until they needed a scapegoat.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Precisely.
I think Oppenheimer was portrayed, you know, I think that helped his portrayal, seeing him react, you know, interact with the president, because I think he was portrayed as scientifically brilliant, but politically naive. Yes. You know, at first he was convinced, okay, we need this because if we don't have it, the Germans will get it first and they won't use it the way we will. They'll be a lot worse than us. If we let them have it, we have problems. As soon as it's taken from him and used, you know, he feels that guilt of the fact that it's used in Japan. But then he wants to say, okay, now that it's used, it got, you know, it stopped World War II. Now we need to level the playing field. And they were not going to do that. And I just thought that was all really well done. I'm sorry. I think you had something to say, Chris.
No, I was just, I was just going to kind of echo everything, you know, Sean had said about, you know, that interplay between, you know, the president of the United States and then the man who basically made this, you know, helped us end, you know, World War II, and how I think that's a perfect description of the character of Oppenheimer. You know, nobody's going to question the man's brilliance, but, you know, his naivete when it came to, you know, the machinations of, you know, how government works, and especially at the highest levels, you know. So, hey, thanks for giving us this great toy. Now go run away.
Yeah, exactly. You know, at this point, we just want to use you as a figurehead to say, look, this is the guy who, you know, the scientific genius who gave us the advantage. And that's all they want him for. He's right. A publicity toy. Or right. Tool. So that, you know, it's, I think this is why I think the movie is realistic, even though I don't know all of the historical facts, because it just feels true to the way things work. There were other actors in here who did an excellent job. There's other people who, you know, were significant. I don't have anybody else I wanted to focus on, but if either of you has anybody, you can bring them up now.
I think we covered there's obviously a lot of bit players in this one that, and I'm not dismissing them by any stretch. Chris, is there anybody that you had left?
No, just, the only other one maybe, and I didn't realize it was him until a couple of scenes later, but the, character played by, Josh Hartnett, you know, who tried to, you know, convince Oppenheimer to tone down his politics. because he was consorting with, you know, the people who were undesirable or you shouldn't be associating with, you know, in the United States, even though the First Amendment gives you the guarantee of not just free speech, but also, you know, association, you know, regardless of your politics or your religion. So, but I was like, oh, I can't place it. Who's this actor? And then it hit me. I was like, oh, that's Josh Hartnett. I hadn't seen him in a film in quite some time. And then, of course, Kenneth Branagh, he plays, I can't remember the scientist's name now, but another big...
Niels Bohr.
Yeah. Yeah. Right. A huge, huge physicist of the time as well. You know, and it's like this meeting of all these great scientific minds coming together. I thought was intriguing and fascinating.
Agreed.
The only other piece I'd note as far as it, and it's kind of more of a general statement about the acting talent in this, when the bombs are dropped, you know, when that whole sequence happens, there's a wide variety of reactions. You know, Oppenheimer's giving his speech, you know, in front of that whole crew. Mm-hmm. And there's moments where he's pausing and reality's setting in. They had all this scientific enthusiasm and about moving the needle forward, about scientific discovery. And then there comes a point in time where consequence of what you've done and what you've created comes crashing down in a variety of ways. Some people are naive to it, you know, in the room there it's hoorah, you know, the war's end, that type of thing. Mm-hmm. But then you see pockets littered all the way through of a variety of reactions. And even Oppenheimer's own visual of what, in realizing what that does to a person who is there, a victim of the whole thing. I thought those sequences, there were so many extras in those sequences, so many smaller parts that got a chance to shine in those sequences. Their reactions, if it wasn't a larger group of people having those reactions, I don't know that it would have been as powerful. I liked that it wasn't everybody in the room universally reacting the same way.
Right.
I liked there were people outside of the room that you saw reacting a certain way, people vomiting, you know, when they were out there because of crushing reality coming in, a couple huddled together crying, you know, over what happened. It was, and other people just rally crying, you know, hey, the war's over. That honesty of depending on where you were at mentally and the realization of what just happened is, was something that was, I thought that added a sense of realism to it. And they, even extras that they had or smaller tiny parts where we couldn't even pin down who was that character, I thought were well cast in this. Casting is something that this film did very well. I guess that's a question I would have maybe as we move away from the cast. Did you feel there was anybody that was miscast? Anybody that felt awkward in this film or shouldn't have been? There's no right or wrong answer to that. I'm more asking you guys, as we watch, it's a 3-hour film, a lot of people in it. So is there anything that you felt like, I wish they done that?
I can't say that there was anybody that stood out as, you know, like glaring that shouldn't have been in the very, you know, whatever role. So I would say the casting was great.
There's times when I watch a movie and it's not necessarily a reflection on the actor, but if I start getting caught up in, oh, that's so-and-so, that it takes away from my appreciation of their performance sometimes. And that's a flaw with me as opposed to the actors. But for some reason, when I was watching this, every time he came on the screen, I kept saying, that's Kenneth Branagh. For some reason, I saw the actor and not the role. And that wasn't his fault, but that was just what happened in my head. Mm-hmm. So it might have benefited for me if it was an actor I didn't recognize, but that isn't to say his performance was in any way flawed. So that it's just like, again, it's probably my own flaw.
I think that's true of any film journey, though, right? You're transported and you don't make it out of the transport at the time. You know, I'm in the story and now I'm not. So I think that's true of an authentic journey.
Mm-hmm. So now I wanted to talk about the music a little bit. And again, I'm going to have to get to my own personal weakness in this regard. When I watch a movie for the first time, it's hard for me to watch it as a critic. I need to kind of do twice to do really a true critic's mm-hmm. viewing of it. And I don't even know if it's fair to call myself a true critic. But anyway, movie scores in particular, usually I am much more cognizant of them when I watch the movie that I've already seen saying, hey, we're going to review this on the show. This is the first time I ever saw Oppenheimer. And usually if I'm lucky enough, I bury myself into the movie and I don't really wear my critic's hat as I'm watching it. So I don't pay quite as close attention to things like the score. I do kind of remember the score. I seem to remember there were points where I thought the movie and what was being played were almost counterintuitive to each other. And I thought that was an intentional choice that was made to try and show you just a little bit of the upheaval of what was going on, even though it felt like a calm scene. I think it was one of the things, quite frankly, that probably made the movie feel a little bit more epic and made it feel like there was a little bit more conflict sometimes when we weren't actually seeing it on the screen. So in that regard, I thought the music was very, very effective to create a mood. But I think if I watch it a second time, I'm going to pay much more close attention to that, and I may change my opinion slightly. But I'm curious as to if you guys had an opinion as to the score.
This is one of those movies, and I've referenced it multiple times. I felt this was a 3-hour journey, and I don't say that not a 3-hour trudge, a 3-hour journey. And there's a vast difference between the two. A journey is something I'm proud to be on. I'm enjoying it. I'm enjoying the ride, whether it's, you know, a happy movie, sad movie, everything in between. I felt the music did what it was supposed to do in all the right ways. It took me on that journey. Sometimes it evoked emotion where I needed it to. I think you're nailing one of the pieces where you're right. There's certain sequences where the music sort of appears to be in conflict, but it's supposed to do that because it's building you up. And sometimes there's films where the music score is so subtle and doesn't, you know, it's supposed to be. It's supposed to kind of hang out in the back and just kind of subtly take you through. This one had a very active musical score at various points during the 3 hour. I mean, 3 hours is a long time. It wasn't throughout the entire film, but at the right spots, music was sometimes helping get you where it needed to, because the scene, not because of anything wrong, the scene couldn't on its own. The music needed to help get you where you needed to be. And that's where I thought the score was successful.
Yeah, I believe that the composer, Ludwig Göransson, if I'm saying that correctly, I don't know if he's Danish or whatnot, but he won the, I think he got the Oscar for best original score for the film. And I think it was deserved. I think Nolan used him previously in Tenet. Cause he's had a long collaboration also with, you know, one of the most prolific film composers, Hans Zimmer, for some of his other films, you know, the Dark Knight trilogy, Interstellar, Inception. But I think the score for this film does help bring along the overall arc of the journey, as Sean describes it, through the film. And there's some key parts to where the score really enhances the scene. Almost the music on itself helps push it. That is the magic of, you know, film composing and film music. And to come up with a, you know, you kind of wonder, how does a composer come up with a score for as epic a film as, you know, Oppenheimer or what have you? And I, I've gone back and listened to the soundtrack, you know, and I've had it on in the background as I'm reading or getting ready to, you know, go to sleep. And it's an incredible soundtrack, I think.
Okay. Excuse me. Any before we get to rating the movie, anything else, any other key points that you think we may have missed that are worthy of mentioning at this point?
No, just echoing the, you know, Sean's endorsement of seeing it on the big screen. You know, there's still being in the comfort of your own home is great and everything, but some films can't get the proper respect if you don't see it on the big screen. And Sean referenced earlier too, here in where we live, we have the Cleveland Cinematheque, and they're a great source of, they bring out a lot of different films that you're not going to see in the traditional multiplex or theater. And then they also will bring back, they call it their a second look series, where they're going to bring back new prints of, you know, classic cinema. And I know Sean and I are both members there, and we get that their bi-monthly thing with announcing the latest films, and I eagerly open that up to see, okay, what's coming on the big screen that I've never seen. So do yourself a favor if you can and see it on the big screen. I hope to one day.
Okay, so I guess now we will rate this. I'm a little torn on this, quite frankly. And again, as I said in the very beginning, we're not talking about was this good or was this bad. We're talking about was this good or was this great. I am hard-pressed to find any flaws with the movie. I think, you know, without having seen its competition, I think it is certainly a worthy Best Picture winner. But not every worthy Best Picture winner hits my level of classic all-time movie.
Right.
So I sit here and I'm torn between, is this a very high Jaws 2 or is it a Jaws? That's really the only question before me. And I think I might change my opinion upon a second viewing when I get to even really go closer into it, and I may see more flaws than I saw the first time, or I may see more subtleties and greatness that I didn't see the first time. But right now I'm feeling like I'm landing on a very high Jaws 2. Again, hard-pressed to say anything is wrong with this movie, but I just don't know if it hits the classic level for me. So I'm gonna leave it there for now, and upon second viewing, I may have a different feeling about it, but I'm not going to do another episode on it, so the listeners will have to speculate for themselves whether or not my opinion will change. Chris?
I'm gonna put it at the level of the Jaws. I think that it is worthy of the Best Picture Oscar, and I think that this may go down, although Nolan has not shown any signs of hanging up his directorial hat anytime soon, which is great for us that love film. But I think this might rate as maybe his best picture to date. I feel that strongly about it. Now, to be fair, you know, like Paul said, I've seen it only the one time. So, you know, how am I going to react? This is based on my initial reaction. You know, will I be a little more, I'll probably look at the film a little more critically the second time around. And who knows, maybe my opinion will change or maybe it reinforces it. But as it stands right now, that's where I stand.
I'm going to say Jaws, but I'm going to say Jaws on the big screen. I've seen it both. I've seen it at home and I've seen it on the big screen. Loved it at home. I would recommend anybody listening to this, if you haven't seen it, watch it at home. It's a great movie to see there. On the big screen, there is something. I mean, and there's certain movies where, I don't want to say it doesn't matter, but your home experience is just as authentic and just kind of a shot. This one was shot to be viewed on the big screen, it was, and it feels like it was shot to be viewed on the big screen when you see it there. That was, I was lucky enough to see it on IMAX. I'm going to say that lucky enough. And it was shot to be seen on that kind of screen. And it's beautiful on the big screen. The music, the visuals, everything that was put together. I think that this is an example of an experience that I would recommend committing to seeing it that way. It's an interesting movie because there's nothing like, it's funny, Paul, you put it at High Jaws too. I don't disagree with any of your reasoning as far as feeling that way. I think this is a film that I think everyone listening to this is going to interact and either has or will interact with differently. And I think that's why, though, I think it's a Jaws, because I think it's worth everybody listening to this seeing if you haven't already and having your own experience with it. You may wind up in different places than all three of us, because I think it is one of those films that is very personal. And I think if we kept going, Chris and I, while we seem very aligned on this, I think there's going to be parts where our own personal attachments may be very unique with this kind of film. And that's where I think it's an interesting artistic film. Mm-hmm. And I think that you can have, like we had here, three different experiences with this film. Recommend seeing it if you haven't already. Do yourself a favor and engage with this film on some level.
Even though I didn't give it the highest of possible ratings, I still recommend anybody who hasn't seen it should. It is a worthwhile experience, no question. Thanks, Chris, for coming on with us. I appreciate your time.
I appreciate the invitation. It was a pleasure. Thanks. Nice to meet you.
You as well. And I would imagine we may get a chance to talk about some more movies down the line.
That would be great. Thank you.
So, thank you again for coming on. Thanks, Sean, for, as always, bringing it to the table. And thank you, everybody, for listening. And we'll see you next time. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
And how many people were in these open discussions?
Too many. Compartmentalization was supposed to be the protocol.
We were in a race against the Nazis.
And now the race is against the Soviets.
Not unless we start.
Robert, they just fired the starting gun. What's the nature of the device they detonated?
Data indicates it may have been a plutonium implosion device.
Like the one you built at Los Alamos. The Russians have a bomb. Truman needs to know what's next.
What's next? Arms talks.
Arms talks.
Obviously.
What about the super? Does Truman even know about it? Did we brief him on that?
Not specifically.
We still don't know if a hydrogen bomb's technically feasible.
Right, my understanding is that Teller proposed it?
Yes.
At Los Alamos?
Teller's designs have always been wildly impractical. You'd have to deliver by ox cart, not airplane.
Hobby.
Sorry, Dr. Lawrence, you want to comment?
No.
Because if it can put us ahead again, the President of the United States needs to know about it. And if the Russians know about it already from a spy at Los Alamos, then we've got to get going.
There's no proof there was a spy at Los Alamos.
Robert.